Studio.
That's it.
Studio 360.
With Kurt Anderson.
Because this is Halloween weekend, we've got a whole hour of stories about how the makers of culture, of literature, of movies, of television, of all of it, scare us. The art of being scary. To start, we've got the director of the Evil Dead trilogy, Sam Raimi. His movies really have everything you need in a horror film, a cabin deep in the woods, college students possessed by demons, and then a hero who knows how to fire up a chainsaw and does.
Mama's gonna buy you a mockingbird.
After the success of those Evil Dead movies, Raimi switched to making more mainstream movies like Spider-Man and Oz the Great and Powerful. But in between those, he dipped back into the supernatural with the movie Drag Me to Hell. I like Drag Me to Hell. It stars Alison Lohman as a sweet mortgage loan officer who's got to evict this elderly, apparently gypsy woman from her home.
Another extension is out of the question.
Where will I live?
I'm really sorry.
Never have I begged for anything, but now I humble myself before
Dennis,
you.
Please.
I beg you.
Please let go.
Please let go.
Security!
You shame me.
Sam Raimi, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, are the gypsies angry at you? Are the Roma people angry at you?
Well, I never actually said that that old woman was a gypsy, for starters. Perhaps that's your own prejudice coming out.
Please.
However, I've got a little bit of gypsy blood in me, and my mother always used to threaten me that my Aunt Minnie would put the evil eye on my brother and I if we didn't behave. This is after her terrible pinches would fail. So my brother and I wrote this story based on the idea, what would happen if that evil eye actually did get put upon us.
As Urdog Sion paid.
It's not really the old woman who is the villain of the piece. It's actually the very sweet and pretty young face of Alison Lohman. She's the one that denies the old woman kindness. She's the one that sins out of greed and throws the old woman from her house. Yes, the old woman strikes back with a curse, but really that curse is put upon her with a condition. Soon it will be you who come calling to me, she says.
Soon it will be you who comes begging to me.
But unfortunately, the old woman dies before Alison has a chance to get that curse lifted from her.
So you really do regard the witchy, gypsy-ish woman as the victimized person in this piece.
After Alison's character makes the sin, there's a demon from hell that comes up as punishment and torments her. And I wanted the audience to know that they were guilty of that sin too, and it was not just coming for Alison, but coming for them.
We are all soulless yuppies.
Well, at least we're all guilty of the sin of greed. It's rampant around us, and I wanted the audience to pay the price for it.
After you've made the Spider-Man movies, these huge blockbusters, and you could presumably do almost anything you wanted, why make the choice to do this relatively low-budget horror picture?
Well, I've had the good fortune of having made some horror films in the past called Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, and they have a very small but devoted following, those pictures.
Those films that came out when I was young.
That's right. That's right. I'm an old man, and you are a young, handsome fellow, I can tell you, audience, as I look upon them. But that horror crowd is unlike any other crowd, and even more than the highfalutin art and film lovers, the real crowd that loves cinema is actually this horror crowd. They go to these films with open arms, with an attitude like, thrill me, I want to be thrilled, I'll give back to you, just give to me. And I wanted to make a film for them, for my own good.
Do you remember the first horror movie you saw as a kid?
The first horror movie I saw, I can't remember the whole thing, I don't remember much of it, but it was called The Screaming Skull. And I was just remember some terrifying image that, again, my mother had to pull me from the theater because I began shrieking in front of the entire crowd.
I used to do that too as a kid and then never went to horror movies again. And Yours is the first one I've been to in about 20 years as a result. You, however, obviously were drawn to the idea of, oh, that really scared me. Now let me try to do that.
It took me a while to learn an appreciation for the craft of making a horror film and the art of it. I had an aversion to them because they so terrified me. I'm such a coward. Even now, I can't see that many horror films.
Really?
It takes time for me to recover.
So to the degree this is a return to your roots, I'm wondering, as a boy in Michigan, you were shooting Super 8 films with an idea toward this is my life and I'm teaching myself how to be a film director?
I was just trying to make better and better films because when I would show my bad films to the audience, it was a tremendous amount of suffering I would go through. They would boo them.
These are your friends.
That's right. They were my friends. But I tried to show them to paying audiences because you get a much better, more honest response from a paying crowd. Even as a student filmmaker, would charge them a dollar, 50 cents, whatever they could afford. Then you'd get a realistic response. And I would then take the films back and try and make them better. I'd recut them. I'd resound them. I'd reshoot a joke to make it funnier. And I'd show it again. And that process is really what taught me how to make films.
Well, and your films actually can be very funny. I'm thinking of, for instance, the third movie in the Evil Dead trilogy, Army of Darkness, which becomes totally slapstick at one point. Let's listen to this clip of your childhood pal, Bruce Campbell, who is playing your hero, Ash, who has been sucked through a wormhole into the Middle Ages.
For that arrogance, I shall see you dead. Yeah. All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up. See this? This is my boomstick! It's a 12-gauge double-barreled Remington. S-Mart's top of the line. You can find this in the sporting goods department. That's right, this sweet baby was made in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Retails for about $109.95. It's got a walnut stock, cobalt blue steel, and a hair trigger. That's right. Shop smart. Shop S-Mart. You got that?
That was Army of Darkness. I find that scene incredibly funny. And you obviously have a comic impulse that you let loose fairly often.
Thanks for that. Yes, I love comedy. And they're kind of very closely related, you know, horror and comedy. They seem to complement each other quite a bit.
Well, and watching Drag Me to Hell, as my audience is scared about what's about to happen, they are also laughing at their own fear. I mean, they are literally intertwined.
I see something terrifying and I titter because I'm scared. And so I've tried to put a lot of black humor into the film so that the audience could have that reaction often.
Tell me about the special effects in Drag Me to Hell versus Spider-Man. Do you begin thinking differently about how you're going to pull off moments because of the budget in terms of the effects that you can do?
Absolutely. With Drag Me to Hell, I wanted a much more immediate response from the audience, something that hit a much more on a gut level. And what happens, I find, when I work with digital effects is this. I have an actor and a green screen, and I direct the actor, and I say, look at the green screen. Now imagine a truck is coming. It's coming closer. Closer still, it blows its loud horn. Now hit him with the air, fellas. Hit him with the air blast. And they hit him with the wind fan, and then there's an explosion that takes place upon the truck, and a lighting effect will hit the actor. And the truck rolls toward you, I shout. He delivers this performance in this way. He hears what I say. He has to imagine it in his mind. He has to project it onto this green screen in his imagination, and then he has to react to it. Then later, not only is that a diluted process, but an animation act.
Diluted, not diluted.
Well, it is impure because the actors react. That's what they do. They're not supposed to manufacture, project,
right,
interpret, and then react. It's just asking too much. And the audience is very intelligent, very intuitive. They know that something artificial is happening.
You show up in a lot of your films. Is that an homage to Hitchcock?
No, I used to show up in some pictures. And then I was in one called, I won't even give you the name because I respect your audience too much. But my wife saw my performance and she said, Sam, I come from a family of actors and I have such a great deep respect for the craft and art of acting that you shall never act again. And that was the last time I appeared in a picture.
So now your mother's 1973 yellow Oldsmobile appears in every movie instead.
That's right. That car, the Delta 88 Royale Classic, if you don't mind, is playing quite an important part in Drag Me to Hell.
It is the non-gypsy evildoer's car.
That car had always been in the Super 8 movies that I made as a kid because it was my mom's car. Then when I went off to college, it would happen to be in those films because I was using that car. And after a while, I realized it had been in every film I had ever made, and so I just kept putting in those pictures.
Has the Smithsonian asked you for it yet?
No, but it's available to your listeners right now on eBay.
Sam Raimi, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Since that conversation, Sam Raimi has resurrected his original claim to fame, now as a TV series on the Starz channel. Ash vs. Evil Dead was just renewed for its third season. And as you just heard Raimi explain, you can't always get those gut-level special effects with green screens and digital tools and computers. If you want to make gore that is really convincing, you may need prosthetic limbs and makeup and buckets of artificial blood. Our producer, Matt Kavnar, went out to Western Pennsylvania to find out how the industry's best create those illusions of impaling and dismembering. Here's that story.
Romero called me and said, start thinking of ways to kill people. You know, we're going to do a sequel to Night of the Living Dead called Dawn of the Dead. And that was it. The 80s came, and I was the king of splatter, the wizard of gore, you know, all those names they called me.
That's Tom Savini.
And that the rest is history.
The special effects master, who put actors through the meat grinder and slasher flicks from Friday the 13th to The Prowler. He got his start with horror director George Romero, and then made his name as the guy to call if you need a pitchfork stuck through somebody, or an arrow, or whatever.
I was always partial to the arrow coming through Kevin Bacon's chest. It was in one of the Friday the 13ths. As a kid, watching that and just seeing that come from behind his chest was just amazing.
Kevin Fears, that's his real name, is the director of marketing at the Tom Savini Special Makeup Effects Program. The school is Tom's baby. He wanted to pass on his trade and, as a Pittsburgh native, he wanted to stay local. And Manassas, just half an hour south of Pittsburgh.
It's a 16-month program. It's a degree program. It's an associate degree. I mean, we have a lot of successful students who are working in movies and shops and things like that out in L.A. and Hollywood. But we do have students working in medical prosthetics, students working in the toy industry.
The students are all rabid horror buffs.
Favorite Savini effects.
They have favorite Savini effects the way most kids have favorite bands.
Probably in Dawn of the Dead when the zombie jumps on the box and gets the top of his head cut off by the helicopter.
Jen, a new freshman, came from Nebraska to attend Savini.
I guess I would capture bugs and dissect them. I wanted to know how things work, and I wanted to know how to recreate them. Not so much, like, mechanically, but just, like, appearance-wise. Like, you know, aesthetically, I just want to know how they work. Human nature, you want to know about that sort of thing anyways. And some people are like, ooh, that's disgusting. And then some people can look beyond the disgusting, and so.
Jen dresses mostly in black. Pretty much every student here does. Remember those kids who'd sit at the back of the classroom? At Savini, they're fighting to sit at the front.
I can see this on the internet. Don't go to Tom Savini's school, man. He whips people.
On the second day of class, Savini gives an orientation speech to the new students. He tells really gross stories and explains the finer points of cutting people to bits.
We just cut the whole section of his chest away, and it's the same way we did the cockroaches coming out of E.G. Marshall. But as soon as those roaches hit the floor, this is, of course, when the body gets cut in half by the pendulum.
This man is living the dream.
Well, my first effects job, I was 14. I saw in the newspaper, live on stage, Hollywood monsters, you know. And they would pick Dracula from the audience, a kid in the audience, you know. And I made sure they picked me as Dracula. I had my own makeup kit at the time. I could see the audience looking at the stage, and I was in a side entrance with the cape over my face. So just before I was ready to come on, I sneaked out and got real low on the floor, and it was time for me to appear. I jumped up in front of the crowd, and you could see them pushed back in their seats. They were so afraid. Well, that was it. I became part of the group, and they took me with them now to all the movie theaters, and they paid me in chocolate milkshakes, okay, and silver dollars.
The kids eat this stuff up like blood pudding.
It's really cool because you're like, first you're starstruck, and then he talks, and you're like, this is Tom. He's just like, he's like one of us.
But Tom is not one of them. He's not a 20-something reared on slasher flicks.
My stuff was very realistic. And I think that comes from having been a combat photographer in Vietnam. I saw the real stuff. I saw real gore. But to me, behind my camera, because, you know, I was a still photographer, there was a safety behind the camera, and I treated it all like special effects. So if I saw something horrible, in my instant reflex was to study it, to imagine what I would have to do to create it with materials that aren't flesh and blood, you know. So if I didn't get the same feeling when I create the fake stuff that I got when I saw the real stuff, the fake stuff wasn't real enough.
You could look at Tom's career as one long replay of the horrors he witnessed at war. Maybe it's easier for him to get a handle on them if he's in control, recreating what he saw. But even if it's for therapy purposes, you can't chop off heads forever.
I'm an adjective. The Savini-like effect, you know, I see that all the time in reviews.
You know, Savini doesn't really do so much makeup for films anymore. He refers a lot of his work to his students.
Lloyd Kaufman runs the Troma Studio. Lloyd is the king of horror pulp movies in America. He needs people who know how to make people bleed.
Poultrygeist, I know we had a two or three graduates of Tom Savini's school who worked on Poultrygeist, without a doubt. And in fact, some of the best chicken zombie makeup was applied by Savini graduates.
People think of movies as glamorous, pretty faces and big budgets in Hollywood. But effects work is dirty, blue-collar stuff done by self-styled outsiders.
I think Tom Savini and I both champion the underdog. There are very talented, brilliant young people whose only downside is they are the Van Goghs of today.
But what's the good of ripping someone's leg off if you can't brag about it? Every year, around Halloween, the students design and work at Tom Savini's Terror Mania, a local haunted house that's like an open studio, if all the artists were Francis Bacon. But the ultimate surprise might have been the appearance of one of the attraction's final monsters.
Tom himself, from Dusk Till Dawn costume, too, as Sex Machine.
Sex Machine is the vampire Tom played in the Tarantino film From Dusk Till Dawn.
He fooled me, and I know Tom. I thought it was Tom. And you know, I got a little close, like, oh, wait. But it was very good. He just got me. He got me good.
If imitation is the highest form of flattery, Tom Savini couldn't ask for more than this. His students have locked his doppelganger inside Terror Mania to scare the hell out of people every night, which is probably, for Tom, something like a little vision of heaven.
Matt Kavnar brought us that story. You can see some excellent work by Tom Savini's students at studio360.org. And if you go to our podcast feed, we have several more stories about how artists spook us, like this one about a composer who makes haunted houses sound haunted.
Sometimes I'll arrange these big 2, 3, 4 in the music. When the boom happens, that's everyone's cue to do something, you know, really wild.
You can hear that by subscribing to Studio 360 at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up now, maybe you're looking for a place to hide out from monsters and axe-wielding maniacs?
Yes, the spare room is available. It's a no-sex house, which I try to tell people before they come, because you can hear everything.
How rooming with the novelist Colson Whitehead led to a zombie apocalypse. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Studio 360.
We are now more than a decade into full-on zombie mania. There are two zombie shows on AMC, The Walking Dead and its spin-off Fear the Walking Dead. There's a zombie comedy on the CW called iZombie. At the Cineplex soon, there will be The Third Wave, an upcoming Ellen Page zombie drama, Cargo, an upcoming Martin Freeman zombie drama, and Patient Zero, an upcoming Natalie Dormer zombie drama. It's a trend that just won't die. So where did all this come from? Is there some pop cultural equivalent of Patient Zero where zombies in culture began? Producer Jonathan Mitchell tries to figure it out.
Whether or not you'd enjoy seeing a zombie movie depends mostly on how much you enjoy seeing blood, vomit, and splattered flesh.
Come here, big fella. Just gonna take a little off the top.
It is satisfying in a pretty morbid way.
Ruben Fleischer directed the recent hit movie Zombieland, a comedy.
I think there is an undercurrent of humor to zombies. They're kind of this brainless, mindless, walking dead. You don't feel bad about shooting them in the head or smashing them with the baseball bat.
And if you do start to feel guilty, it'll all go away when you realize they're really mean.
They just relentlessly keep coming at you. They're very, very hungry.
You got a purty mouth.
And they go crazy and try and kill you and eat you. And like a relentless rabid dog that's going to rip you to pieces.
I think they're more menacing when they move slowly.
George A. Romero, director of Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, lots and lots of dead movies, isn't a fan of the newer, faster zombies.
You know, you'd think that the first thing they did when they woke up was go to a gym.
I mean, one thing that we should talk about, I don't know if you're aware of this sort of rift in the zombie community.
A lot of people seem to think that zombies are scarier if they run.
For sure.
And I'd rather just have this slow-moving thing that's hard to stop.
I mean, do you consider like a zombie like in Zombieland or 28 Days Later that runs fast? Do you consider that even a zombie?
I don't know.
Why not?
I just can't believe it. First of all, I don't, you know, who makes these rules? I make the rules up for my own guys, and they're dead, and therefore they move slowly, and if they tried to run, their ankles would probably snap.
But at the same time, when Romero started using these monsters in the late 60s, calling them zombies was a bit of a stretch.
When I made my first Living Dead film, which was Night of the Living Dead, I never called them zombies. I never thought of them as zombies because the origins of the zombie are, you know, deep in the Caribbean. I always thought of them as those boys that were doing the wet work for Lugosi in films like White Zombie.
Zombies? Yeah, they are my servants.
You know, that was a voodoo thing. Real zombies in Haitian lore are in sort of a state of suspended animation caused by, you know, a voodoo priest mixing up a potion. And, you know, they mix up this cocktail and then puts you in this state and basically makes you a slave. And I thought that was a very specific kind of a monster. And so I didn't think my guys qualified.
What distinguished Romero's monsters was that they weren't being controlled by some voodoo priest.
They're not controlled by anybody, no. They all of a sudden, the dead stop staying dead.
Are they slow-moving, Chief?
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
And they're the result of an apocalyptic nightmare.
The only explanation I've ever had in any of the films is that there's no more room in hell. And I just called them flesh eaters or ghouls.
Supposed that a ghoul can be killed by a shot in the head.
But it was when people started to write about the film, they called them zombies. So I said, maybe they are a new kind of zombie.
And ever since then, Romero has built his career on zombie movies. Zombies in a mall. Zombies in an underground military bunker. Zombies in a walled city.
I mean, listen, you can throw zombies into anything.
Throughout the 80s and 90s, the Romero version of zombies came to define what a zombie is.
Slow-moving walking dead that had risen from their graves.
But that all changed in 2002 with the Danny Boyle film 28 Days Later.
It transitioned to a more viral...
It was a virus.
contaminated rabid dog almost.
The infection was everywhere.
It's like once you've seen a fast zombie running at you full speed, I think the slow zombies just aren't scary anymore. And I think that, with no disrespect to Mr. Romero, like those movies just feel dated inherently.
I grew up on things like The Mummy, and I'd rather just have this slow-moving thing that's hard to stop.
What these two versions of zombies have in common is their apocalyptic vision. Hordes of relentless creatures that were once human.
The neighbor as a monster.
They're people.
It might be your brother or your sister or your oldest friend.
But because they're either dead or infected, they're not living in the same way that we are.
These creatures are nothing but pure motorized instinct. We must not be lulled by the concept that these are our family members or our friends. They must be destroyed on sight.
And if you start to feel guilty, just remember, they're really mean.
That's Jonathan Mitchell. Do check out his excellent podcast. It's one of my favorites. It's called The Truth. Hollywood isn't alone in the culture industry and being obsessed with zombies. The book business also has its share of zombies. Colson Whitehead is a terrific literary novelist, currently the author of the great and best-selling The Underground Railroad. But he also published a novel about zombies called Zone One. And Zone One isn't some postmodern take on the genre. It's smart and funny, but it's also the real deal. Brains are eaten, and the living go to war against the undead. Back in 2011, when that novel had just come out, I asked Colson to come in for a live event at WNYC.
So howdy. Zone One takes place after the end of the world. People are pretty much bummed out, more than usual. They're walking around with PASD, or post-apocalyptic stress disorder. And when they get really bummed out, they can look back upon last night, the last sane night in the world before everything became really horrible. And Mark Spitz, our protagonist, not the actual Mark Spitz, it's an ironic nickname in quotes, is thinking about his last night story. When he was six, he walked in on his mother giving his father oral pleasure. A public television program about the precariousness of life in the Serengeti, glimpsed in passing, had introduced him to dread, and it had been eating at him the previous few nights. Bad dreams, the hyenas and their keening. He needed to slip into his parents' king-size bed, as he had when he was very young, before he had been banished to his own big-boy bed in accordance with the latest child-rearing philosophies. It was forbidden, but he decided to visit his parents. He padded down the hall, past the green eye of the carbon monoxide detector, that ever-vigilant protector against invisible evil, and the bathroom and the linen closet. He opened the door to the master bedroom, and there she was, gobbling up his father. His father stopped his unsettling growls and shouted for his son to leave. The incident was never referred to again, and it became the first occupant of that corner in his brain's attic that he reserved for the great mortifications. The first occupant, but not the last. It was, naturally, to that night his thoughts fled when on his return from Atlantic City on last night, he opened the door to his parents' bedroom and witnessed his mother's grisly ministrations to his father. She was hunched over him, gnawing away with ecstatic fervor on a flap of his intestine, which, in the flicker of the television, adopted a phallic aspect. He thought immediately of when he was six, not only because of the similar tableau before him, but because of that tendency of the human mind, in periods of duress, to seek refuge in more peaceful times, such as a childhood experience, as a barricade against horror. That was the start of his last night story, Everybody Had One.
Colson Whitehead reading from his new best-selling novel, Zone One. Wow. Freud called it the primal scene. You have one-upped Freud.
Well, yeah, I mean, he didn't, I think, foresee the zombie epidemic or zombie plague. He was working with
one of his many insufficiencies. Yes.
I guess I have that in my corner.
There you go. So you're a MacArthur Foundation genius, and now your characters are eating each other's colons. How did you end up writing a horror novel?
I didn't have much of a choice. I was a bit of a shut-in as a kid. Other kids like to go and leave their houses. I just spent my afternoons watching The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits and reading Stephen King. And until I got to college, I basically wanted to write The Black Shining or The Black Salem's Lot. If you took any Stephen King title and put The Black in front of it, that's what I wanted to do. So for me, I always knew I would write a horror novel eventually. And from watching zombie movies as a kid, I've had zombie anxiety dreams for the last 30 years. And I had one that led to the idea for this book.
Really?
Yeah, well, some normal people have anxiety dreams about being late for an exam, or they haven't prepared for the big presentation.
No, the escaping thing I've had, but specifically escaping zombies?
Oh, yeah, that they're fast, they're slow, they talk, they get me, or I escape. So this is my life. And actually, since I've been on book tour, people have come up to me and said, like, I have zombie dreams too. So maybe a support group is in order. But the idea for Zone 1 came because I guess the summer of 2009, I had house guests out in Long Island. And the house has very thin walls, and you can hear everything that happens. So I woke up one morning, they were laughing and playing. And I was in a bad mood, and I just really wanted them to go. But you can't really say that to your house guests. It's a no-sex house, which I try to tell people before they come, because you can hear everything.
You can keep on your shoes, you can smoke, but just don't have sex.
Yes, the spare room is available. It's a no-sex house. If you bring corn, we'll put it on the grill. And so I heard them laughing, and I couldn't join in because I was sort of in a depressive episode, and so I willed myself back to sleep and had a dream that I was in Manhattan. That's why it was a dream, because I live in Brooklyn. It was a nightmare, and I wanted to go into the living room, but I wasn't sure if they had swept the zombies out. And then I woke up, and I was like, that's a real consideration. After the apocalypse, how do you get rid of the zombies? They stick around like bad house guests. And that became a book.
Gotcha. I remember a decade ago when my children were small and just being amazed that they both, as 6, 8, 9-year-olds, completely were familiar with zombie protocol, like what killed them, what didn't kill them, how they lived, how they got that way. And I didn't understand how this information had propagated into my, you know, little kids' brains. Why did zombies, do you think, the last whatever decade or so become so interesting to them, to you, to the world?
Well, when I was writing the book 2 years ago, my daughter was like, I know zombies, I've seen Scooby-Doo. And she thought that I should title my book Awake of the Undead Army, which is, you know, a little longer than Zone 1. I can only talk about my weird orientation. And my interpretation of the zombie horror is that everything that you've suspected is true, which is that your friends, your family, and everyone in the community is a monster who wants to eat you. So they've been pretending for decades, biding their time, and then one day you wake up and they want to eat your face. So that speaks to my sort of Freudian troubles, I guess. And that's what animates my version of the zombie.
And voila, it's a bestseller.
Now that I guess I'm not alone.
There you go. Your parents let you watch George Romero? They let you do what you wanted in terms of cultural menus?
Well, if you allow your kids to go to Crazy Eddie's and rent the big stack of Betamax tapes every Friday, you won't have to talk to them. So... And we were allowed to see any kind of R-rated movie. I saw Clockwork Orange when I was like 10. And I remember as a family evening at home. And I remember being like, Mommy, what's happening? What are they doing to that woman? And her being like, it's a comment on society. And
you had intellectual parents.
Yeah. So I think it's, you know, it's during my work, and I think it helped, even though it was not particularly appropriate.
How about with your own kid who is 8?
She's 7.
So, yeah. Are there things you won't let her watch?
Well, I want to show her All the stuff I love, like Alien. I do want to show her Dawn of the Dead. So another 10 years for that. I try to stick with the herd in terms of like the Brooklyn parenting advice. I don't want to be stoned to death in the street. So that means not a lot of drinking while I'm pushing the stroller. I'm not
no
smoking.
Vaccines.
Right? No. So I'm trying to stick with the community standards.
That's Colson Whitehead. Since we last talked, Colson Whitehead has definitively stepped up into the pantheon of great American novelists with his latest book, The Underground Railroad. Coming up, if you're looking for the next great horror movie auteur, maybe forget Sundance or the NYU Film School. Maybe check out your local Sunday school.
He knew that I had been raised as a fundamentalist Baptist, and he said, "You were raised that way, right?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, just drag all the skeletons out of your closet."
Say amen, Wes Craven. He's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. It's almost not possible to drive by one of those flickering neon vacancy signs without somebody in the car making a crack about the Bates Motel. National hotel chains these days are so ubiquitous that the old mom and pops with hand-painted signs instead of some familiar logo now seem inherently noir. How did that happen? It turns out our scary movie zombie expert, Jonathan Mitchell, is also our scary movie motel expert.
The year was 1980. I was 9 years old, and my family was about to leave on a 2-week vacation, driving in our Plymouth Volare from Illinois to California. It's a week before we leave. I'm watching TV, and I see this.
You may never again spend a night away from home. After you spend a night with Ida and Vincent.
Ida will show you the way.
You want us to register?
No, that won't be necessary.
This trailer was about creepy motel owners who bury their guests alive and turn them into beef jerky.
Motel hell.
That was the first time it ever occurred to me that a motel could, in fact, be owned by a psychopath.
And I mean, well, what I think is interesting about that is you could see the desires of consumer culture to make motels attractive and safe places as connected with America's innocence.
David Lederman, he wrote a book about road movies called Driving Visions.
It's a movie that shows you that, well, you need to think twice.
What happened to the motel? People started dying.
You see it all the time in movies, like 2003's Identity.
There was a storm.
A stranded traveler is desperate for a place to stay.
We got stuck at the motel.
And then they're greeted by a creepy, shifty-eyed desk clerk, like in 2007's Vacancy.
Give you two the honeymoon suite for $5 extra. It's got a few perks the others don't.
Motels are always just a little bit lower brow.
All right, well, give me my card.
Ooh.
Seedier.
We're not set up for plastic here, friend. Cash only.
Jan Matlock is a cultural historian who teaches at University College London.
My absolute favorite motel film in all of motels is Touch of Mink.
Why would she go away with someone like that?
Who knows? He's a man and she's a woman.
That's the most dangerous combination to turn loose in a motel.
That's where people go to have illicit affairs.
I forgot to tell you about that. I registered as Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, you did?
Mm-hmm.
People can be anonymous.
And that can be fun in romantic comedies. But in film noir, it's dangerous.
The first film that comes to mind for me is this classic and now famous very low-budget B movie from 1945 called Detour.
I love Detour. That's one of my favorite films of all time.
If only I'd known what I was getting into that day in Arizona.
The actor Tom Neill plays a piano player who's hitchhiking across the country from New York to Los Angeles and gets picked up by someone who ends up dying while they're driving.
Mr. Haskell, what's the matter? Are you hurt?
He decides to, oddly enough, take over the guy's identity.
I'd have to be Charles Haskell until I got to some city where I could leave the car and be swallowed up.
And the first thing he does is he checks into a motel.
I knew I had to hit the hay and hit it hard.
Motels are associated with crime and evading the law as a kind of ominous way station where important plot developments occur that further embroil the characters.
Margot? Hello there, Schwartz.
In the 1958 Orson Welles film Touch of Evil, Charlton Heston plays Vargas, a Mexican detective whose wife, played by Janet Leigh, is left alone in a motel while he solves his case.
I have first to drop my wife at the motel.
Vargas has this faith in American culture and society represented by the motel that will be a safe place.
What's the name of that motel?
The Mirador.
And it turns out not to be a safe place.
That Mirador is mighty hard to find. With the new highway branching off the way it does.
The motel is not even on one of the new highways. It's on one of the old ones. So it's really in a kind of nether zone.
When she gets there, she finds a nervous and creepy desk clerk, played by Dennis Weaver.
There ain't no dead man.
And then all these gang members show up, and they're quite disturbing because they're so invasive.
The Dennis Weaver character is quickly convinced to leave.
Andate de aquí, loco. Anda.
Beat it.
And let this band of hooligans take over.
Yes, ma'am.
She calls to find out something, and they say,
I'm very sorry, Mrs. Vargas, but the telephone is temporarily out of service.
Nobody is going to get to you unless I say so.
I'll call you just as soon as it's repaired.
And of course, the irony of that moment is that he will say so.
No! No, let me go!
Close the door! Ah!
You're in somebody else's space.
It is very scary, I think, to be, you know, spending the night living with that kind of open access.
I think that so terrified me when my family drove across the country back in 1980.
Right, right.
I was finally cured of that fear in 1982 when I saw Poltergeist. Remember the end? The family is finally escaping their incredibly haunted house with the scary TV into the warmth of a nice, clean motel. See, motels can be safe, as long as you hide the TV.
Thanks to Jonathan Mitchell for that story. Nobody defined the modern American horror movie more than Wes Craven. If he didn't make your favorite scary movie, the person who did probably stole the idea from him. Craven wrote and directed The Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, and A Nightmare on Elm Street, all of the Nightmares on Elm Street. And when he got tired of just the straightforward versions of all the horror film tropes he helped invent, he started delightfully deconstructing them in the scary but funny Scream movies. In 2014, I talked to Wes Craven and asked him when he decided horror was going to be his genre.
After I made my first film.
Really?
Yeah. I was just basically learning the very rudiments of making film. I hadn't studied film or anything, but I had impulsively quit my college teaching job and come to New York. And I had met a guy who had made a small film that I ended up working on. And at the end of that film, the backers, who were a bunch of guys in Boston that owned outdoor theaters, told him, we need a scary movie. So he came to me, said, Wes, these guys want a scary film. Can you write something scary? I said, I've never even seen a scary movie. And he knew that I had been raised as a fundamentalist Baptist. And he said, you were raised that way, right? And I said, yeah. He said, well, just drag all the skeletons out of your closet. So I went and wrote a script, Last House on the Left. They liked it, and we made it. And I was a horror filmmaker.
Here is the first motion picture to offer to the daring a look into the final maddening space between life and death. The last house on the left. To avoid fainting, keep repeating.
It's only a movie. Only a movie.
Those voices were my family, actually.
Really?
No, not really.
That was your father. You'd recorded him when you were very young. So why were you able to knock it out of the park the first time?
You know, I don't know. That's the honest answer. I mean, you know, I was born the month Hitler invaded Poland, so there was the world was at war for my first 5 years. I had a father that was kind of scary that died when I was quite young, so I was introduced to the disappearance of a parent and death. And I was, you know, a quiet kid in school. I was the one that got chased around by the bully. So the way people look at people who make scary films is kind of backwards. You know, it logically you would think, oh, they must be scary themselves. But a lot of them grew up being the kid who was scared of the bullies and the crazies and getting beat up. So you
– That pretty much means all artists. But
– Yeah. Well, it does. And you know, when you sit down to think of somebody scary, you can just think of somebody from – from when you were in sixth grade getting beat up all the time. That's how Freddy got invented, really.
And did you get – do you feel like you got better at it over the years of filmmaking and making these kinds of films in particular?
I hope so. Yeah. I hope so. You know, it was always a matter of – well, with the Nightmare series, I did two that I actually wrote and directed. It was always trying to go up to the next level to figure out – I think the last one I did was discovering kind of the meta level of – having people that made the original film actually be the characters in the last film. And then was fortunate enough to get the script offered to me for Scream.
Which is meta in an entirely different
way. Totally meta, yeah. And, you know, kind of just breaking the walls down and going into areas that were interesting, but even more about the culture and the culture's sort of love affair with media.
So many of your films deal with sinners being punished. And does that, as I'm sensing it does, come from this fundamentalist background? You went to a Christian college?
It was more like religion might not protect you as much as you think it does. And that the thing that really will endanger you more than anything else is falling asleep. And I meant that in the sense of not being awake to what is a clear and present danger to you in the most real sense and not going into denial.
Thank you very much, sir.
It's my pleasure.
Wes Craven died last year, alas, just a year after we talked. Wes spent a lot of time here, actually, because he agreed to judge a short horror film competition that we staged and couldn't have been more engaged and generous with his time and just nice to us and to the winner. In fact, you can hear his conversation with the winner where he tells him he's won at studio360.org and see all the short films that were entered. That's it for this week's show. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast feed. You'll be getting my interview with Alice Cooper, a story about a photographer who may be shooting you while you're alone in your kitchen, and from Jack Handy, tips to prevent grave robbers from stealing your skeleton. Find those in iTunes or wherever you get podcasts. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. The team here includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Krista Ripple,
Sam Kim,
Skylar Swenson,
Tommy Bazarian,
Zoe Saunders,
Gabriella Cortez,
Judy Gu,
Jackie Harris.
And I'm Kurt Anderson. Thank you for listening.
Me, Dracula. Run.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, a pop musician who definitely doesn't buy his gear from Guitar Center.
There's only one of these in the world, and this instrument taught me a lot about my own voice, actually.
How Jacob Collier got MIT to make him a special electronic harmonizer. He performs live next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.